to just go back quickly to the idea of mixing disciplines, right? And one of the really powerful things about mixing disciplines, and why you can have sort of demonstrations like this, is because, you know, an artist, a psychologist, a games programmer, a computer scientist, an engineer, all sat down and just built that game, built that sort of idea. And it means you don't reinvent the wheel. So you're not, everybody's not doing the exact same thing, and then just find, oh my god, you were already doing that. The construction of proof of concept makes difficult concepts tangible. I mean, maybe I'm, you know, speaking out loud here, but I would say that a demonstration like that is far more powerful than listening to me talk about it. It's a powerful demonstration of an idea. It makes tangible these concepts. And in terms of, you know, making this sustainable and economic, these are ideas you can build into digital companies and media companies and so on, which would be very sellable. The whole stress management, executive toys industry, for example, love the idea that we're actually doing. I talk about the 5-year window because if you look at the difference between, say, what Media Lab Europe does and, say, a development lab and a business, development lab and a business, you know, like an Ericsson or whatever it might be, they will be looking at next year's products. And a university will be looking at that things maybe much further down the line, 20, 25 years. I remember when I was doing my master's degree a couple of years ago, the actual algorithm or the mechanism for interpreting, you know, signals in a mobile phone environment was developed in 1972 by a guy called Forney. And it was 30-odd years later that it actually became manifest in standards of technology. Okay, so I'm going to quickly go through the Mind Games group. I'm looking at the time here. I won't spend too much time on this, but essentially what the Mind Games group is, it's looking at these skills that we could learn in the virtual world that we can bring back into the real world. And in particular, it's looking at skills for people that would find themselves outside of the mainstream in some way, you know, be it in terms of some kind of cognitive reason or social reason or physical reason or whatever it might be. We're looking at people with gaming skills in the group, artists, we've got psychologists, computer scientists, medical people, and so on. And one of the things we're trying to do is we're trying to build up a much bigger framework so these kind of things can be developed. So the framework is pretty much like this. We have this engine in the middle of all that we do. We call it the Symphony Engine. And basically what that does is it's actually an engine that typical games companies would use. But rather than just having a joystick controlling the things on the screen, we have all these biometrics controlling that. And then we interact with various people through the Higher Education Authority and our sponsors and so on. The lab is sponsored by corporates mainly, and public funding at the moment, but the idea is that it will ultimately be sponsored by corporates. Okay, so here's, I'm just going to throw a couple of ideas and projects that we're doing. I won't go into all the details, just to give you sort of a different way of thinking about how we might use technology. This was an idea called Brainchild, and it's a video game. I can't show it to you here now, but it's a video game where the better you get at controlling a biometric, so say for example it might be your heart rate, it could be alpha waves in your brain, it could be your skin response, that becomes a power in the environment. And it's this idea, if you think of the Star Wars metaphor, this idea that you can do Jedi magics just by changing your mindset, that you get this power in the environment. And we've done this lovely idea where you can actually have a piece of technology guide you into a state of deep relaxation. And the reason that works is because you're developing this power all the time. And as you're developing this power, you're opening or unlocking this door. So the simple idea is that to demonstrate that by putting someone into a very immersive environment, you can actually improve their ability to learn how to control their biometrics. This was a demonstration inspired by people that were in that would be extremely autistic. And the idea is that you would pick up a ball and it would measure your heart rate and your skin response. And then you could track this ball in a virtual world, and by putting pressure on the ball, you squirt paint into this virtual world. But it's also picking up your biometrics at the same time. And so the particles of paint are affected by skin response and by your heart rate. And so you draw this picture and it's dynamic. And when you come back the following day and you pick up the ball, the picture changes. And it dynamically gives you your outer state that you drew and your inner state while you drew it. This would be similar but musically inclined. This idea is that you would control the pitch, the variance, and so on of a piece of music. put in your favorite piece of music, it gets pulled out in different ways. And as you're in a different state, the music changes. And so you have to get back to that state to hear the music that you would like to hear. And it's a way of encouraging you to control your biometrics. This was it's one of my favorite demonstrations. Again, I'd love to show it to you. If you get a chance to come down to the lab, have a look. It's a little bit hard to set up. But the original motivation for this was to reward somebody for being still. That was the original motivation. And the idea was that you would stand in front of a virtual mirror and see yourself. And then you would pick up two orbs, two different colours. And as you were still, you vanished from the picture and you were replaced with this energy. And then the energy was used to reveal things. That was the original motivation. It was to try and encourage kids to sit still, maybe in a classroom or whatever. But then some dancers came along and said, no, no, no. What you really need is to encourage beautiful, gentle, soft motion. Right? And so a whole wonderful collaboration happened between ourselves and Central Media Clinic. And we actually performed this at the Geneva World Summit last year, where we had people that were able-bodied and dancers that were full-on dancers dancing together in front of this screen, creating these energies and flows. And anybody could do it. That was the beauty. It was completely accessible to anyone. So one of the things that we were thinking of doing, extending this, is this idea of maybe rewarding somebody for doing nice, gentle Tai Chi movements so that you get rewarded for that. And in a rehabilitative context, that would be very good. Because oftentimes, under rehabilitation, you have to do repetitive exercises which are quite boring. Making it into a nice game or something that's immersive and enjoyable could be very useful in that regard. The beauty of it is that you're measuring biometrics and motion at the same time. The combination of those two, a very nice combination. Here's another interesting idea, is controlling a virtual world with your breath. I mean, everybody knows, for as long as we've been evolving, that the breath is one of the fundamental things that dictates how you feel pathologically. It turns out, for example, that your body can be in what's called an anabolic state, which is typically when you're asleep, or a catabolic state, which is more dominant when you're awake. In a catabolic state, it's fight or flight. And in an anabolic state, it's much more about consolidation, and that's why, for example, you heal better, as I said earlier, at night. It turns out that the breath can predispose you to either, your pathology to either of those states. I mean, it doesn't control it, but it can just predispose you. So deep breathing is a really good thing to do. I mean, yogic people, people that do Tai Chi, all these things, they know this, intuitively. Deep breathing is a really good thing to do. So the idea of this game was to help children that are in hospital, but they've got a lot of catabolic energy. I mean, kids have loads of energy, right? But they may have gone through an operation. And if they don't use that energy in some way, or if they don't shift their bodies into a much more anabolic state, their sleeping patterns get messed up. So the idea here at the Mater Hospital was to try and develop a game where people would breathe deeply and get rewarded. And in this game, you control the flight of a creature. And as you breathe deeper, the creature's direction is controlled. It's a unimodal interface, but it works really, really well. And the way we do it is we measure your diaphragm. When you expand your diaphragm in a deep breath, you produce a lot of electricity in the stomach. This is probably the most, how would you say, it's advanced in terms of, but ambitious probably project, in that we're looking at the idea of attention in the brain. The brain produces particular responses when you're attentive. That unimodal interface I showed you in the first talk is not a very scientific way of doing it. What we would like to do is really understand what happens when someone is paying attention, measure that electrically, and then reward someone for paying more attention. And a very simple test of measuring attention, which is developed in Trinity College Dublin, and it's one of our collaborators, Ian Robertson, who's the head of psychology down there. If you present somebody with an alternating letter, like X, Y, X, Y, X, Y, and then randomly put in two X's and then randomly put in two Y's, it turns out that over time, if you make more errors than you should, it's a good measure of sustained attention. So what we did is we built a video game where you'd be chased in a maze and you uncover tiles as you run over them, red, green, red, green, red, green. And as you're playing the game, you have to notice that two greens or two reds happen. And as you do that, then we know we have your behavioural attention. And what the idea is that we will ultimately be able to measure that and hopefully improve it as you play the game. I've actually missed the slide, I'm going to jump from Billy to Jack here, but this is supposed to be one after this. Here's another one that personal investigators developed by John Sherry, who's a psychologist working in the group. It's a lovely illustration of how you can use online chat rooms in a very different way. We all know how badly they can be used. But this is a fully interactive chat room, 3D, beautifully rendered, so it runs on a web page. And the idea is that you can share information around depression and suicide and so on with kids that will be like that in a very safe and encouraging way. And it's built around a psychological construct called solution-focused therapy, looking at the solutions rather than the problems. And John has built this beautiful world with his students, and it's the one that the O2 Digital Media Award in the Consumer Division last year. This was the one that was supposed to be for it. So, say for example, someone's running in this video game, and this will check where you're paying attention. It's also check whether I was paying attention too. But anyway, if we're back at the attention game, the mental leaps. If someone's running along the maze and they're not noticing, for example, that two reds or two greens and so on, what we do is we've built this device called the Cerebus System. And what that does is it sits on your head. I admit it's not a fashion accessory, but it sits on the head, right? And it monitors, it's completely configurable to any point of the head, and it monitors brain activity. And what we do is all the batteries, all the transmissions, all the products, all wireless, it sits on your head and it transmits information to a device like this. So you can be moving around and doing all various things while you're wearing this, and we're monitoring your brain activity. And we're extending this idea with NUI Minute to do something, I'm not sure if I have the time to explain it, but just something quite remarkable, and that's this. It turns out that if you shine light at an infrared or a near-infrared frequency, it actually passes through the skull. A certain amount of the photons in the light will pass through the skull. And remarkably, oxygen-carrying blood or hemodynamically active blood will absorb at that frequency. Now what that essentially means is that the parts of your brain where there's a lot of hemodynamic activity, in other words, that's where the brain is active, will absorb at this frequency. And that means we can see if that part of the brain is active. Now unfortunately, oxygen-carrying blood goes to the part of the brain after neurons have been fired, so it's a sort of you get a bit of a delay of whether that part of the brain has been active. But it's a remarkable discovery. It's been discovered about 2 years now. And it's particularly useful in children because their skulls are very thin. But anyway, it is still possible to do it with adults. And the idea behind this is to build a multimodal, again that word, brain interface system where we can do lots of things, look at all kinds of tasks and monitor brain activity accordingly. And the beauty of it is we can build this for about 300 or 400 euros. If you want to get your brain scanned, now obviously you get a much better scan with an MRI or whatever. You have to lie down, you go into a 1.2 Tesla magnet, which could shift a car. It's not exactly something to carry around. This would be a very simple, poor man's version of that, but it would allow you to do things like monitor things over time in a way that brain technology won't allow today. So what I thought I'd do is, just before I go to the clubhouse, which I'm running out of time, so I'll rush to this, I'll just give you an idea of how we work, right? This is a very simple idea. I'm looking at a mapping of the brain here across what's called the motor cortex, which is the part of the brain across the top of your head, between your ears, right? And what I've done here is, I haven't done this, but somebody else has done it, we've mapped out how much of the brain is used for different parts of the body. Now, if you look down at the corner here, on the bottom there, your bottom right hand corner, you'll see the tongue, okay? That turns out to be almost as big, it's not the fingers now, but the hand. It's this huge part of the brain that's devoted to the tongue. And the reason that's the case is because your brain needs to control the tongue critically, just in case it blocks your windpipe. If your windpipe's blocked, you die probably in a couple of minutes. So it's critical. It also turns out that there's no skin barrier on the tongue. And the reason for that is that we need to be able to detect poison and all that kind of stuff, or we needed to in the past. Obviously, it's not as big an issue nowadays. And also, there's a huge, dense amount of nerve endings in the tongue going straight back to the brain. Remarkably, for someone that has, say, a degenerative disease, like motor neuron disease or cerebral palsy, statistically, it's not always true, but statistically, the tongue is the last part of the body to be affected by that disease. And so what we did was we built this device that, this is Ross, one of our students, I'm sure he'd be disgusted if he saw that photograph up there, but the idea here is that you put a stimulator into the mouth so that, say somebody that was blind or somebody that might not be able to hear, they could actually get a stimulus presented to their tongue that goes straight back into the brain. And the idea is there you've got sensory substitution. And in addition to that, we put a set of resistors, switches basically, into the mouth, which allows somebody select and switch using their tongue. So as a simple device for someone in those kind of extreme conditions, this is a very, very powerful device. And again, we can build this for next, you know, with the new Bluetooth technologies and sensors and so on. So, and this is going back to these partnerships to realization. If you start thinking about using technology in a different way, you really do come up against serious barriers. There's no point talking about it unless you engage different partners. I mean, it's fine talking about this. Most people would agree with many of these things, but at the end of the day, who's going to pay for it? How is it sustainable? How is it going to be built and so on? Right? And the power of these things is that you need businesses. I mean, anybody that thinks that we can, you know, change the world without the business community, I think maybe we can in a millennium. But this is the real powerhouse of the world today, and we have to get these people engaged and connected and using the resources in a very different way. What I was pointing out in some of these things is that, and I always argue this, is that if you deal with the hardest case first, if you want to build a human interface for someone, try it with somebody that has no arm movement, or no speech, or limited head movement, whatever it might be. And then the rest of it's easy. Everybody else is easy after that. But deal with the hardest cases first. And this is the idea. We conceive, create, and commercialize based on an inclusive agenda. I honestly do believe that that's where we have to start thinking about. We've got to start thinking of inclusive agendas rather than just individual agendas. And the other thing about this is where the technological profits idea comes in, is that if people do go through a system of working on technology like this, they become, in a sense, evangelists themselves. They go out and they tell people and inspire people and so on. And so having a whole method or means for bringing people into work with these kind of technologies is a whole evangelical approach in many ways, the exact same thing.